Good morning. So last time we talked about exceptions, and this was a mechanism where hardware would sometimes need the operating system to handle something. We had a whole bunch of different kinds of cases where this happened. So one set of cases was when the program did something that required the OS's attention. This could be the program had some abnormal behavior, like it accessed memory that's not supposed to be accessible or divided by zero, something like that. It can also be kind of very deliberate behavior by the program, that sometimes the program needs some help from the OS to do things. You might say, well, why can't the program just do this directly? And we learned that a big reason why was this notion of kernel mode, that there's some things we don't want to just let programs do. So for example, if programs could talk directly to the hard disk, then this means that we couldn't enforce that your programs can access your files and not other people's files. Because the hard disk, well, it's just going to let you read things or write things. So to prevent programs from doing dangerous things, we restrict some operations, such as talking to hard drives, to kernel mode only, and we decide that we only run the operating system in kernel mode. And what this means, we need some way of switching to and from kernel mode, and this mechanism running in the OS is going to be how we do that. And we're always going to run non-OS code in user mode. You know, so the OS always gets to decide how these special dangerous operations happen and make sure they happen in a way which is acceptable. So that was things where the program did something that required the OS's attention. We also have cases where the program doesn't do anything, but we still need the OS's attention. So one example was if a program keeps running over and over again, the OS needs some way of regaining control. And we said, well, the OS can set a timer. When that timer goes off, the processor will be informed, and it's going to stop the program from running and start running the OS instead. We also have cases with I/O devices. So for example, if I get a key press or some data in on the network, or the disk says I'm done reading, we want the OS to be able to take control and handle that operation. And often, the OS will be handling the operation for a program that isn't running. So I might press a key, but the program that's currently on the processor, whose registers are loaded, might not be the one which cares about that key press. But we still want the OS to run, even though that program doesn't have any code to deal with key presses. And so we'll have this mechanism where the hardware will run the OS and say, hey OS, what do you want to do about this key press? Or what do you want to do about this network packet that came in? And so on. So that mechanism I mentioned is called an exception. And the basic idea is that at boot, the OS sets up a table telling the hardware, here's where I want you to run me when one of these events happens. And generally, the OS will have separate handlers for each kind of event, and will give the hardware a pointer to its list of these handlers called an exception table. And the hardware, when the event happens, will call one of these exception handlers, taking care of doing a little bit of saving where the program previously was so the OS could go back to it if it needs to. So questions about sort of the mechanics of exceptions. So one of the things that having the OS get to run at some points lets us provide is this kind of illusion for programs that the programs just have a processor to themselves, even though that processor is really shared with multiple programs. And we called this kind of idea that we had your programs having their sort of kind of own machine, this notion of a process. And there's two components to that. So the first component is called threads, is kind of what exceptions give us, that programs get to run on the processor directly, and as far as they're concerned, they can set all the registers, they can, you know, write loops that keep running forever, and it seems like they just basically have a whole processor, or possibly multiple processors, to do this on. But in fact, those processors are likely shared with the OS and other programs. And exceptions are a way of implementing that, that in fact, what happens is that even though you've written code that kind of assumes you're using the processor all the processor really actually gives control over to the OS at some point, and you share that processor. And to implement this, the OS needs to save what you were doing, when it gets control and restore that later. So when you're not running, you still have all your register values not changing and so on. And you go back to like where you were stopped. So from your point of view, it just looks like the processor was still running without any changes. The other part of this notion of a process, this sort of kind of, it seems like you have your own machine, is that it seems like you have your own memory. So when we have programs, the programs can generally like choose how their memory is laid out, and it doesn't matter what other programs are on the system. And also that if you access crazy memory locations, this is not going to affect the OS or other programs. It's only going to affect your program. And to implement this, we have this idea called an address space, that your program has a bunch of addresses it can access, and those are your program's addresses. They are the system's addresses. And to implement that, we have a hardware support where we have this mapping from your program's addresses to the real addresses that the operating system sets and that the processor implements. And we started talking about what that mapping looked like with this notion of virtual memory, that we have this your addresses that you can access split up into fixed size pages. We divide up the real addresses into the same size pages, and we just have a table say, you know, your page X is physical page Y for every page X. We'll talk more about that later today. So questions on this notion of a process and our abstractions of a thread, this kind of virtual CPU, and an address space, this kind of you own the whole memory, even though for both of them, in fact, you know, we're sharing a CPU and we're sharing the memory with other programs. But you write your programs as if you're the only one using the memory, you're the only one using the CPU. Questions? Okay, so I'm gonna go over some of the quiz questions based on scores. Start with question one. So for question one, the scenario being set up is that we said, well, when we use vector instructions, we have these load instructions where we get sort of a vector of usually like a of x plus 1, a of x plus 2, and so on. We'll be asked to like load from a of x. This is the sort of vector load instructions we've learned, and the store instructions are similar, that we supply the beginning of the stuff we want to load, and we get a whole bunch of stuff from that place to memory. And the question was asking, maybe we could have a fancy load instruction, which would let us, say, load from a of x and a of y, and like a whole bunch of other locations. We just specify a vector of pointers, and we get a vector of the data from each of those locations. And this would mean that we don't have to have our loads and stores be things that are right next to each other in the arrays. They could be scattered in the arrays however we like. Now, the disadvantage of this is that these loads and stores would, of course, be a lot slower because they're doing something a lot more complicated. They're like going to have to access the cache a whole bunch of times, and making them efficient is a lot of work. But they are, in fact, a thing which exists on like GPUs and some processors. You know, they put the work into implementing these kinds of instructions, but they're not going to be as fast as our load a contiguous bunch of stuff, load and store instructions. And the question is, where would these be useful? And for our first two examples here, they probably wouldn't. If you think about vectorizing this code here, probably when we try to use vector instructions, we want to like access a of 0, a of 1, a of 2 together, and b of 0, b of 1, b of 2 together, and so on. So we'll end up not having any real advantage to having these instructions that would let us do things that aren't next to each other. All the things we want to do for this first example are next to each other in the arrays A's and B. So like kind of loading a big contiguous chunk is exactly what we want to do. The normal loads and stores are great. And the same thing is true for our second set of loops here, because J is that inner loop. We can vectorize doing basically like J equals 0 through 7 altogether. And when we do that, the loads and stores we want are loading, you know, contiguous chunks of A, B, and C. That's going to work fine with the loads and stores we learned in the lab. So questions for why these two examples, we don't really want the fancy loads or stores? Okay. So for the last two examples, we had a case. So for this example with the T array, the T is like looking up array indices, so we might end up with just sort of random places in A, and with our normal loads and stores for vectors, we really couldn't use them for that. Instead, probably what we'd have to do is we'd have to like have a loop that one by one loads each different element of A, because they might be scattered all over the place, depending on what the values in T are. But with a vector load instruction, we could actually make this work. We could just, you know, we could load a whole bunch of values from T using a normal load, and then we could use that to compute a bunch of pointers to A and pass that to this fancy load. So it would be a real benefit for this example. And for D, I made a typo on the quiz, which is why the question was dropped, but if I made it so it wasn't an infinite loop by not putting a zero, because 0 times 3 is 0, which is still 0 when you multiply it by 3 again. So I made it 1 to make it not an infinite loop. Then we'd be loading A of 1, 3, 9, and so on. This is something we could do with that fancy load instruction with one sort of load instruction, but it's not something we can do with our normal loads using one load instruction. Okay, so questions? So quiz question 2 was asking where things were stored when we had this code running, and we basically had an exception happen after this second move and before we finished the app. So what's going to happen is that we're going to run the OS. The OS is going to do some stuff. The OS is going to get to run again, and then it's going to start back, and the first thing it needs to do is run the app again. It can't jump to like the middle of the add, so the add is not going to be partially done. The add's not going to have happened at all as far as the OS is concerned, because in order for us to switch back to this program, we have to switch back to a specific instruction, and the only good choice is that add instruction. And that means the OS is going to have to save the values that are RAX and RCX so that add instruction will work, and it's going to have to restore them when it goes back to the program. But while we're switched away to the OS, we are here, we're running, you know, another program. And that program needs RAX and RCX. So the OS needs to save the value of RAX and RCX somewhere. And it's going to save it in its own memory. So I guess one of the points of confusion is some people, we had an option saying, maybe they'll save it in the program stack. That is not something generally we're going to do. And the big reason why is that we kind of break the illusion that you have your own dedicated processor. Because if we put values on your stack that you didn't put there, that's not what the processor should do, right? If you had the processor yourself, that wouldn't happen. So the OS can't save the values there. It needs to save them somewhere you can't see. So it's invisible to you that it happened. Questions about this context switch scenario? Yes?
So for option A, I guess like the idea is that the program does have the illusion of its own memory, but doesn't have the illusion of its like own register, so this register.
So question is, for option A, you're saying, option A was saying, oh, the value 200 is stored in one of the processor's registers. And the question is, doesn't the program have the illusion it has its own registers? So yes, the program has the illusion, it has its own registers, but the implementation of that illusion doesn't always put those register values in real registers. So the program thinks, oh, RAX, or in this case, RCX contains 200, but the way that's implemented is when the program's running, RCX really does contain 200. When the program's not running, the value 200 is instead stored by the OS somewhere. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, skip over three. Question 4 and 5. Another scenario where a process asks to read from a file. So how does that work? Well, the process can't do that directly because, remember, talking to I/O devices is reserved for kernel mode. We have to ask the OS for help. So the process is going to say, hey OS, I want to read this file. And it's going to do that with a system call. So that's going to run the OS, and the OS is going to do whatever it needs to do to talk to the disk to start that operation. And we said in this scenario that while that was happening, the OS needed to wait for the disk to finish something. So it started running process B. Then process B ran normally, and somehow after the disk finished, the OS, this operation finished. And I think the point of confusion was that some people said, oh, that must be something that the processor sort of handles special. And with our traditional exception mechanism, that's not going to be the case. The processor doesn't actually know anything about process A. All the processor knows is that it ran the OS, and then a bunch of registers changed to the values that process A happened to be using. The processor doesn't understand that there's some values for process A, some values for process B. It doesn't have that information. So what must have happened here is the processor ran the OS, and the OS said, oh, this is the event of the disk finishing, and it handled that work of actually figuring out what program to run. The processor wouldn't do that itself because we don't have any way for the OS to communicate to the processor, here are the processes. The processor doesn't know about them. All the processor knows is that it runs something that the exception table points to, and then a bunch of registers change. Is that, so questions about this question, quiz 4 and 5 scenario? So let's move on to talking about virtual memory. So we mentioned that we had our program addresses, which we split up into fixed size pages, and we had our real addresses, we called physical addresses, that we split up into pages of the same size. And we're going to map each of the virtual pages, the ones the program can access, to whole physical pages. And this gives us a table. And this is the table we're going to give to the processor, and the processor is going to implement the mapping using this table. And in practice, it's going to work that this page table is going to be given to the processor. The processor is going to take the address, and it's going to split up the bits of the address, and the upper bits of the address are going to be our page number. We're going to say which of those chunks are we in. The lower bits are going to be the page offset. The reason we can split up the bits this way is that we'll always, always choose a page size that's a power of 2. So when we do the division, it ends up taking the lower bits for the page offset and only keeping the upper bits for the page number. So we're going to take our page number from the program's address. This is called the virtual page number. We're going to look up a page table entry, a row in our page table for that. We're going to check if that entry is valid. And if it is, we're going to take the physical page number and we're going to combine that with the rest of the address called the page offset, so we go to the same part of that physical page as the part of the virtual page that the program thinks it's accessing. And that's actually the value we'll end up sending to our cache, to the rest of the memory system. So questions about our simple page table lookup here? Okay. So one thing to mention is that, oh, we have these page tables, how do we change them? So we're going to have some extra privilege instructions to change them. And we mentioned before that, you know, one thing we need to worry about is that we have to have, like, coded memory to do this. So we want to have the ability to kind of mark that this code is protected from programs by marking it as sort of kernel mode accessible only. We want to have this extra way of, you know, protecting that code which does the switching or all the data for that code so the program can't manipulate it. So we want to have the OS's data be protected for the program even though it's going to be in the memory. And a common solution for this is that we'll have some way of marking pages as kernel mode only, which is going to be an extra column in our page table. Now we're actually going to have other types of extra columns we're going to want. And to give us sort of the, maybe a motivating scenario for that, let's say I'm logged into Portal, a shared machine, and I'm running Emacs, and some other user is also running Emacs. And here's sort of the virtual memory, so here's what the Emacs programs think their memory should look like. And we have two copies of Emacs, and because I'm editing different files than this other user, we expect the data here to be different. That's normal. But we have this code here, which actually might be maybe most of Emacs' memory if I'm editing a small text file. And that should be the same. And it sure seems like we would really like to only have one copy of that code in memory. But there's a question of, can we actually do that? So from the point of view of how these page tables work, the answer is yes, I can have two page table entries, one for my program and one for the other program, these two separate page tables, that both have the same physical page numbers. That's fine. Problem is, let's say one of the copies of Emacs tries to modify its code. They say, well, that shouldn't happen. I agree. But normally, when my program does something stupid and tries to modify its code, like because of an array out of bounds, we expect that the worst thing that can do is crash my program. But in this scenario, if we actually share the memory, the worst thing it can do is crash both programs. And we really wouldn't like it if me doing something funny in the text editor broke your text editor that, you know, even though you were using different copies of the text editor, it seems. So it seems like we can't do this because we've broken the illusion that each program, each process, has its own memory if we share it. But it's really useful to share it. So page tables will commonly have some extra bits to let the processor safely have these two copies of Emacs share that data. And the extra bits are going to be some extra permission bits. So for each page table entry, we'll have not only a valid bit, we'll also have a bunch of bits saying whether different types of uses of this translation are allowed. And when we're actually doing that translation, not only are we going to check if the entry is valid, we're going to check these other bits depending on the access. So for example, if I'm doing a write, in addition to checking the valid bit, I'm going to check if the write bit is 1. And if it's not 1, I'm going to trigger an exception, just like I would trigger an exception for accessing something with no mapping. And when I'm doing an access in user mode, I'm going to check this kernel bit. When I'm doing an access to run an instruction, I'm going to check this exec bit, and so on. And typically, page tables will have a bunch of these extra permission bits that are going to be checked just like the valid bit, and that give the OS the ability to do things like share data, but not have to worry about programs writing it. Yes?
Can you explain a little bit the difference between like the kernel bit and then the like write and execute bit?
Can I explain the difference between the kernel bit and the write and execute bit? So basically, if we think of our page table lookup here, I have a valid column, and this is like trigger an exception of 0. So I'm going to have some additional columns where it's going to be like, let's say our kernel bit is going to be trigger exception if 0 and in user mode, or sorry, if 1 in user mode. User mode. And I might have a writable bit, and this rule is going to be trigger exception if 0 and the program is trying to write. Right, so we'll just have different conditions for when we trigger an exception, but otherwise they're similar to the valid bit. And the differences between like kernel and writable are what the condition we're checking is. So for the kernel, we're checking if the program's in user mode, we're gonna change what we do with this bit, whether we trigger an exception or not. And with the writable bit, depending on whether the program's trying to write to the address or read from it or execute from it, we'll change what we'll do. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So is there no read bit?
Question, is there no read bit? In my example, there's no read bit. The actual bits processors will have varies between processors. So there's a whole bunch of variation on this. I'm just giving the general idea. I'm not saying that these are the actual bits processors choose. Other questions? Okay, so something that I'm kind of hinting at with this PIC diagram here is I have in this diagram 8-bit virtual pages. And if we think of addresses, we think of like 64 or 32-bit addresses on machines, we kind of expect the virtual page numbers probably are a little bigger than the 2 bits we've seen before, probably even bigger than this 8 bits. But with 8 bits already, things are getting unreal. So our next, the rest of this lecture and the next lecture are going to be a lot talking about how do we deal with that problem. So to first talk about that, we're going to talk about the sizes of addresses and the sizes of address spaces, the number of pages we have that we can access in both virtual and physical memory. And one thing you might say is, oh, so the size of the virtual addresses, that's the size of our pointers, right? Because we say that they take the address the program accesses, we do the page table lookup with it. So you would think that the pointer size is the virtual address size. But that's often not true. So we're going to call the virtual address size the size that's actually used for the translation. And a lot of systems, including most 64-bit x86 systems, don't actually use the whole pointer for the memory access. So on most x86-64 systems, only 48 bits are used. You might say, well, what do we do with the other bits of a 64-bit pointer? And basically, there's a rule that the upper bits of the pointer need to all be the same. And then only 48 bits are used. And the only thing that's done with the rest of the bits is to check to make sure they're all zeros or all ones. And when we're talking about the size of virtual addresses, I always mean the size that's actually used for the page table mapping. So if we have some bits like typical 64-bit x86 uses, which aren't actually used to figure out what the real address is, the physical address, we're going to say they're not part of the virtual address, even though they might be part of the pointers. And the reason why we do this is that, well, you know, we mentioned that our page tables are unwieldy. This is one way of making them less unwieldy. Now, if you do some calculations, we'll still say, wait a moment, 48 bits is still a lot. We're still going to have to do extra work to make those practical. That we probably will talk about next time and won't get to today. So that's the size of addresses. And when I talk about the size of an address space, I'm going to be referring to the amount of stuff we can name given the size of our addresses. So if I say I have a 32-bit virtual address, I have a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space. I can name 2 to the 32 individual bytes. And if I have a 20-bit physical address, I have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address space. As physical addresses, I could specify 2 to the 20 individual physical bytes. This is based on the number of unique addresses. It's not necessarily the number of useful addresses. Now, for virtual addresses, this is kind of clear. If we have a system with very small physical addresses, there's no way all the virtual addresses could be useful at the same time, right? Because we only have so many things they can map to. It's a little less obvious for physical addresses. You might say, oh, if we have, you know, a certain physical address size, shouldn't all those addresses be useful? And the answer is often no. And as an example, let's say I have a machine with 3 gigabytes of memory. 3 gig is not a power of 2. there is no way I can have, you know, a number of bits in my physical address where I fully use the 3 gig and don't have any left over. And this is the most common situation on machines, that will have more bits in our physical address than we have actual storage, that corresponding storage. So there will be physical addresses we can specify that don't actually map to useful storage. We still say that we have the physical address space that includes the number of addresses we have, even though, yeah, it's impossible for all those addresses to be useful. And that's just the common case. And it's the common case because, like, if you buy a CPU, you know, it probably supports, like, having 128 gig of RAM, even if you only have, like, 16 gig installed. So that means it supports the address space size for 128 gigs. It has that many unique addresses, but probably in your system, most of those addresses are never useful, those physical addresses. Okay, so questions about address space sizes? Okay, so we're gonna, sort of as our main topic for the rest of the class, talk about, you know, what page tables are. Let's figure out how to make them work given realistic address space sizes. And we're gonna start out with the easier case of 32-bit x86 sizes. So on a 32-bit, you know, x86 processor, you typically have 32-bit virtual addresses, and it's actually 32 bits, none of the bits are ignored. So they're all used. And we're using page tables, and our page size is 4,096 bytes, or 2 to the 12 bytes. Remember, our page size has to be a power of 2, and also, we always choose the same page size for virtual and physical addresses. So there's only one page size. So my first question here is, given this, how many virtual pages are there? So we're dividing up our memory into our virtual address space, all our unique virtual addresses into pages. How many do we have? Who would like some more time? Has answer they'd like to volunteer? Or a way of we compute this? Yeah.
2 to the power of 20.
You got 2 to the power of 20? How did you get that?
So because we have 32-bit virtual program addresses, that means we have 2 to the power of 32 bytes of address space.
Yeah, so we have 2 to the 30 unique addresses or unique byte names for bytes, yeah.
Right, and you know, each page takes 2 to the power of 12 bytes, that means it will be to the power of 32 bytes.
Yeah, so we have 2 to the 32 total bytes we can name, and 2 to the 12 of them per page. So we end up with 2 to the 20, which is about 1 million. That's a lot. That's a very big page table. And it seems like a problem. Let's explore exactly how much of a problem it is. So let's say I have my 32-bit virtual addresses, And let's say my physical addresses are 30 bits, which means that not all my virtual addresses are going to map to physical ones. Some of them are going to be invalid, probably, or mapped to the same thing as other ones. And my page size is the same. And my page table entries have this layout. They have a physical page number, a valid bit, and a kernel bit. That's what I've chosen to put on my page table entries. I haven't put any extra bits. And my question is, how big is the page table? So as far as thinking about this, if we think about our page tables, we have our rows, which is a page table entry. So we want to figure out how big the row is. And the number of rows sort of times the row size is what we want to get, right? So the total size is the number of rows times the row size. So we could separately compute the number of rows, so the number of page table entries, or the size of each page table entries. And either of those would be a good first step to computing the total size of the page table. Would like some more time? Okay, so who can give me a first step? What's a good first step here? So we know, we have our two subproblems, number of rows and the size of each row. So who can give me a first step for either of those two subproblems? Either what the first thing we should do to figure out how many rows there are, or the first thing we should do to figure out how big each row is. Each row being a page table entry. Is the number of virtual pages. So if we remember what our page table looks like, we had a row for each virtual page. So we just need to know the number of virtual pages. And conveniently, we just computed that. So this is the number of virtual pages. This is 2 to the 20 rows. So that's going to be the first part of that multiplication. So then we need to figure out how big each entry, each row of the page table is. So someone give me a first step there. What's something you want to compute to figure that out? Yeah. Okay, we need to know how many bits from the physical page number. Because we know each row is going to have a valid bit. Well, that's probably one bit. and a kernel mode bit, that's probably one bit, but we have a physical page number. We need to know how big that is. Okay, so figure out how big the physical page number is. So how can we do that? Any proposals? Yeah.
Because in the last question, what we figure out is that the virtual page number. So in this case, if you're trying to figure out the physical page number, isn't that just 2 to the power of 30 divided by 2 to the power of 12?
Okay, so you said, oh, we learned that to figure out the number of virtual pages, we took the number of virtual addresses divided by the page size. Can't we do the same thing for the physical page number and the physical addresses? Yeah. So we could say that we have 2 to the 30 total addresses divided by 2 to the 12 page, which means we have 2 to the 18 physical pages total. And if we have 2 to the 18 physical pages, that means our page numbers are 18-bit. Because we need 18 bits to tell which of those 2 to the 18 pages we're referring to. So that is one way we can compute the size of the physical page numbers. So there's another way, which is that we can remember that because our page size is a power of 2, we can divide our virtual addresses and our physical addresses into a page offset and a virtual page number or physical page number. And the page offset is the location within the page, and we can determine the size of the page offset from the size of the page. If we have 4,096 bytes in the page, our page offsets range from 0 to 4,095, which means they're 12 bits. So our page offsets are 12 bits for both of these addresses, and we know the total size of the addresses. So for our virtual addresses, the total size is 32, which means that the virtual page number is 20 bits. And similarly, for our physical addresses, the total size is 30, which means the virtual page number, or the physical page number part, must be 18. We just subtract the 12 from it. And this is just because we know we always split up our addresses into page offset, page number. And it's always possible because our page size is always a power of 2. So when we divide by the page size, we always just strip out the bottom bits. So questions on computing our physical page number size? Yes?
2 to the 18 plus
2? So is the question the size of the page table entry 2 to the 18 plus 2? Yes. Because we have to still have to account for the valid bit and the kernel mode bits. Like, we're still going to need to store those in the page table. So our page table is going to, we're going to have a sort of a column of valid bits, a column of kernel bits, and a column of the physical page number. And we're going to have 2 to the 20 of these rows. In each of these, this is a total of 20 bits. And so that gives us 2 to the 20 times 20 bits, which is going to be, a bit between, over 3 megabytes. So that's pretty big. And if we think of that size and compare it to, say, the size of caches, that seems a little disturbing. So one thing that's disturbing about that is that it would be really bad if, when switching from one program to another, the OS needed to copy 3 megabytes of stuff. That doesn't seem very practical. And remember, this is the 32-bit situation. The 64-bit situation with the same design would be bad, would be worse. And the other thing is that if we can't store like a cache that's more than 32 kilobytes in fast memory on our processor, how could we possibly store 3 megabytes of stuff? So we're going to have a different solution, which we're going to talk about in a bit. So sort of as a prep for that, let's do just a quick exercise on, since we know how addresses are split up, let's split up this address here. And I guess the important thing I want to point out is that you can do this without converting the whole thing to binary, in this case. So I'm going to split this address up into page number and page offset. So first of all, how big is our page offset?
Twelve
bits. We know it's 12 bits because we have 2 to the 12 bytes. Each of them needs to have a unique offset. So our page offset is 12 bits. So how should I extract those 12 bits from this number? So should the bits, so who thinks the bits should come from starting at the 8, the least significant part? Okay, who thinks the bits should come starting at the 1, the most significant part? Thinks they should come from somewhere else? No clue. So we have a split between they should come from the 8 and no clue. So they should come from the least significant part. And the reason why is if we think, look at back at our original scenario, like the page offset was where in that box we were. And it's always the least significant bits because that's what, when we add 1 to the page offset, we're still on the same page. So it has to be the lower bits. So it's always going to be the lower bits when we do the splitting. So we want to take the lower 12 bits in hexadecimal. Each hexadecimal digit is 4 bits. So the lower 8 bits are just the 6, 7, 8. The rest is our page number. Now, if our page size was not a multiple of 4, we'd have to do some funny stuff like converting one of the digits to binary, which would be a little more complicated. So questions about splitting this address? And why our page offset is from the part of the address we got it from? Okay, so let's go to our problem of where can we store this 3 megabyte table? And we're going to have one solution, which is we're going to make the table smaller. But we still have to worry about storing big tables. And our solution is we're going to store them in memory. So we're going to figure out a way of converting our page table entries to integers. And here's an example. I've chosen to take my page table entry and convert it, in this example, to a 16-bit integer. We might have to choose a different size if we have a different size physical page number. In this case, my physical page number is 9 bits. But I've decided that bit 15 of the integer is the valid bit, bit 14 is the kernel bit, bits 4 through 13 are the physical page number, and the rest of the bits are unused. Why did I have some bits that are unused? Well, I wanted to fit it in a 16-bit integer because that's something we can easily store in memory. I can't easily store a 12-bit number in memory, but I can easily store 16-bit numbers in memory. So I'll have some extra stuff in there just to make sure it fits cleanly in a, you know, number that's a whole number of bytes. And I'm going to store these page table entries as an array in memory. And rather than giving the processor a bunch of these array elements, we're going to give the processor a pointer called our page table base register that we're going to set to point to this array of page table entries, which is actually just an array of 16-bit integers that we're going to interpret using this table. So we'll have our pointer to memory, and memory is just going to be a bunch of bytes. But what we're going to do is we're going to take, in this case, pairs of bytes and interpret them as 16-bit numbers. And I'm going to look at, say, our first number. I'm going to say, okay, the first entry in this array, when I'm looking at as a page table entry, it has a valid bit of 0. It has a kernel bit of 0. It has this physical page number, which is all zeros. And so on. Or perhaps more usefully, you know, I can say, the second entry, the one for virtual page 1, not virtual page 0, has a valid bit of 1. The one for the next one, for virtual page 2, has a valid bit of 1. Or if I want to look up the physical page number for virtual page 1, well, that's these bits based on the layout I've chosen. So I figure out what entry to go to because it's an array lookup. So virtual page 1 is at array index 1. Virtual page 2 is at array index 2. I do my usual way of taking a base address and computing how to get to that element of an array, of saying, you know, each element is the size of an array element later. So in this case, our array elements are 2 bytes. So the second array element is not going to be at address 1000, it's going to be at address 10002. That's where I'm going to look up virtual page 1. Virtual page 2 is going to be 10004, and so on. So I get my 16-bit number, and I decode it to get my page table. So this is how we're going to give the processor the page table. The processor isn't going to like take the contents of memory and actually produce this whole table here. What it's going to do is when it has to look up a particular page table entry, it's going to just retrieve that entry, that number, and decode it to figure out what's in it. So we're not actually going to store the whole page table in the processor. We're going to have it stored in memory. We're going to read from it as needed. So questions about this idea of taking our page table and storing it in memory and just decoding it from these numbers that represent page table entries? People, yes. So the question is, how does this interact with caching? So there's two ways this is going to interact with caching. The big one is that when the processor is looking up these page table entries, it's going to use the cache to do that. So in addition to caching the program's data, we'll cache the page table entries the program's using. The second way is that we're going to have a special extra small, extra fast cache just to store page table entries called a TLB. And that's going to be necessary because it turns out if we don't do that, things are too slow. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So this doesn't necessarily reduce the size of the table.
Question is, this doesn't reduce the size of the table? That is correct. But it avoids storing the whole table on the processor, which was the first problem with this table being big. So we're going to have something additionally we're going to do to reduce the size of the table we'll talk about next time. The sort of preview is that we're going to have a simple tree-like data structure that's going to let us avoid storing uninteresting parts of the table. Other questions? Okay, so now that we have this page table in memory, let's think about how the lookup works. So like before, we're going to get an address from the program we call virtual address, and we're going to split it up into our page number and our page offset. So we're going to take the page number, and we're going to figure out where in the array we are. So this is going to be, we're going to multiply it by the time, the size of a page table entry to compute the offset of the array element. So I multiply by the size of page table entry. So in our prior example, 2, like because to advance by 10 elements, I need to advance by 20 bytes if my elements are 2 bytes. So that's what the multiplication is for. And we add that to the page table base register. And the OS is going to set this register, and presumably it's going to have a separate table for each program. So it will change this register value when we switch programs rather than like changing the whole page table. We'll just point to a new table. And that's going to make our context switches still efficient. So that's going to give us the address of our page table entry. And we're going to get from the cache the actual page table entry contents, which we're going to have to decode, right? Because it's represented as a number. But in fact, that number like contains some bits that are like the valid bit and the page number. We're going to have to decode that. That's going to be simple and hardware, but we're going to have to do it. And we're going to like check the valid bit, the kernel bit, and other permission bits to figure out if we want to cause a fault, if we want to tell the OS, hey, this program tried to write something it's not supposed to, or this program tried to access memory you didn't tell me where it was. And if that doesn't happen, we're going to get our physical page number from the page table entry. And that's going to be the upper bits of the physical address. For the lower bits, because we map a virtual page to a whole physical page, we have to figure out where in that virtual page we are to figure out where in the physical page we are. So we're going to copy the physical, the page offset, the virtual page offset, to our physical page offset. And combining these two things is going to give us our final physical address, and we're not done yet. We're going to access the cache using that physical address, and that's what the program actually intended to access. Some questions about this lookup process? Yes? The first part meaning splitting this address or this times page table size? The times page table size. So the question is, why are we multiplying by the page table size? So if we look at our example here, the entry for virtual page zero was addresses 10,000 through 1, right? And that meant the entry for virtual page 1 started at 10,002, not 10,001. Because each entry was 2 bytes. Does that make sense? So that times page table size is taking that into account. So in our prior example, that page table size is 2, but often our physical page numbers will be too big, so we'll need more than 2 bytes to storage entry. But that times page table size is basically, we're doing an array lookup, and we have to take into account how big are the elements of the array. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have our processor. It's looking up in this array of page table entries, the right one, decoding it, doing that. You're possibly making an exception. Otherwise, you take the physical page number, make our final address, actually access memory there. So one terminology thing, we call the part of the processor that does the actual page table lookup the memory management unit. The term you'll see often used for it, or the MMU. So this page table lookup, if we think of our processor, it has to happen twice. In our pipeline processor, in our fetch stage, we're going to have to do this, and also in our memory stage, we're going to have to do this. And this means we're doing like an extra access for every fetch, and an extra access for every load and store. Which seems like a problem. And in fact, it is a performance problem. And it's even a performance problem, even though these page table entries will be in our caches. Because cache accesses generally are, they're fast, they're not that fast. So to make this fast, typically we'll have a special extra cache to avoid looking up page table entries in the first place, called a TLB. And the hope is that rarely will we actually go through this full process. Usually we'll have a cache that has the last lookup, or one of the last few lookups recorded, so we don't have to do it again. But if we don't, we're going to go through this whole access the memory cache, possibly go to the memory, and possibly have 4 whole memory accesses that might go all the way to the main memory just to run one instruction. Some questions. I should add additional cache. So we've learned about storing page tables. We're going to do a few exercises. So first, we're going to start with this example here. So here I have a contents of physical memory. And in this case, our page table is not stored in the memory. We're going to do that, this example, where the page table is separate from the memory. And then we're going to go through an example where the page table is stored in the memory. That second example is going to be like the first 4 of the 6 questions on the memory homework. But first, we're going to do the simpler example. So here I have a page table and physical addresses. And our virtual addresses here are 5 bits, and we have 8 byte pages. So that means we have 2 to the 3 byte pages, and that means we have 3 bit page offsets, because I need 3 bits to tell where in a page I am. So that means my 5 bit virtual addresses, I can divide up into a 3 bit page offset, and I have 2 bits left over, which is my virtual page number. And it's good that it's 2 bits, because if it wasn't 2 bits, this page table wouldn't make much sense. And similarly, I have my physical addresses, which I can divide up into a 3-bit page offset, and I have 3 bits left over, which turns to my physical page number. It's good that it's 3 bits, because if it wasn't 3 bits, these wouldn't make much sense. That sucks. And since my pages are 8 bytes, my physical memory, my first physical page is addresses 0 through 7, my second physical page is addresses 8 through F, and so on. Right, because that's how we're dividing up the physical addresses. And the virtual addresses are divided into the same size chunks, but to figure out where those chunks map to the physical addresses, we have to look at this table. So let's do, try to use this table here. So I have my virtual addresses. I want to figure out what am I going to be accessing when the program tries to access virtual address. We'll start with 1-8. So a good, useful first step is that in binary, as a 5-bit number, this 1-8 is 10000. So I have that split up that way, and I'm trying to do this lookup here, right? I'm trying to take the address, find the virtual page number, look up the page table entry, and use that to form the final actual address. So what should my next step be? So we know we need to split up our virtual addresses. We mentioned that because we have 2 to 3 byte pages, we have 3-bit page offset. Right. So our virtual addresses, we have a page offset and a virtual page number. And the page offset we know is 3 bits because our pages are 2 to 3 bytes. So that means the upper 2 bits, the remaining bits of the virtual address, are our virtual page number. So what are those in this first address, 1-8? What are those upper bits? Yeah. 1-1. So we have 2 bits, and then the most significant 2 bits after we remove the bottom 3 bits. So we can say that these bottom 3 bits, this is our page offset, so what's left over must be our virtual page number. So I have a virtual page number. I have this table, this column here. The index into the table is the virtual page number. So I must want to look at this page table entry. So what are we going to do with that page table entry? Well, if we look at our example lookup here, we're going to check the valid bit and see if we want to trigger an exception. And if not, we're going to take the physical page number and copy that to form an app physical address. So let's look at this page table entry. Is it valid? The valid bit is 1, so we don't need to trigger an exception. Great. So now we need to take the physical page number. So we're going to use this physical page number here. And we're going to use that as part of an address, but we need the rest of the address. And for the rest of the address, we're going to copy that from our page offset, because we want to go to the same part of the physical page as the virtual page the program thinks it's accessing. So we're going to copy the page offset. So this is still our page offset. So in fact, we're accessing address 00, and the value we're accessing is this one right here, which is what value we're going to read or overwrite, depending on how we're accessing that address. Whatever we're doing with address 1-8, we're actually accessing this particular byte of physical memory. Some questions on how I did that process? Yes?
How do you know that each row in the physical address table is 4 bytes?
how do I know that each row in the physical addresses are 4 bytes? Because they're labeled 0 through 3, 4 through 7, so on. Question, could I know how many rows are in each in the table of physical memory values from the information up here? No. You could infer that since we have 6-bit physical addresses, there must be 2 to the 6 values here. So you could figure out that way how big the rows must be if they're given the number of rows, though. Does that make sense? Other questions? So with that, you should be able to do our next 3 examples. Okay, so who'd like more time for 0-3? Okay, so let's go through. So 0-3, if I convert this address to binary, I get 0-0-0-1-1. We know our page offsets are still 3 bits. So 0-1-1 is the page offset, which means everything left over. 0-0 must be our page number, or virtual page number. So virtual page number 0 is the first row of our page table, and I see that it's valid. And my virtual page number is 010. So I'm going to copy that 010 as the first part of our physical address, and I'm going to copy the page offset from the original address as the rest of our physical address, and our new physical address is going to be, if I convert this back to hexadecimal, 1, 3. So I look that up here, and I get that this 4A here, that's the value that the program is actually going to access. Some questions on how I did that process? Can someone tell me what happens for 0A? Preferably someone who hasn't talked, but. Yeah. Okay.
So that's valid bit, and then take the first page number there.
Okay.
111, and then copy offset bit, so 010.
One, and we copy the 010. Okay.
Yeah, and that corresponds to the hexadecimal address 3A.
Okay, so the address is 3A. So we look up address 3A. And that gives us this DC, I believe, which is the value we're actually going to access. Okay, how about the last one? Yeah. Okay, so yeah, so we look at our virtual page number, that's these first two bits here, 10, it's not valid, we can stop, we're done. It triggers an exception. We say, hey, OS, I don't know what to do. You don't need to keep going. Okay. So this is the example where a page table is separate from memory. So let's look at how this would look with our page table in memory. So in this case, rather than having the page table separate, I'm going to say our page tables are stored in the memory. So this means I have a pointer that the OS set in a special register called the page table base register, which points to address 20. So that means our page table starts here. So this is the page table entry for, well, I guess I should say, first of all, and our page tables have 3 + 1 + 4 bits. So our page table entries, this is our 8 bits total, which is equal to 1 byte. So this 1 byte here, that's our page table entry for VPN 0. And after that, we have our page table entry for virtual page number 1, and so on. Right? Because they're stored right after each other. So let's look at address 3-1. So this is going to be 1-1 as a 6-bit address. This is 110001. We have, just like before, we have a 3-bit page offset. So our virtual page number is 110. So I'm going to look up page number 110, which is going to be 6. And so I have pages 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is the VPN, so this is the page table entry for VPN 6. And I'm going to have to decode that based on the information here. So this is going to be 11110. And we know the three most significant bits are the physical page number because it says up here. And then the next bit is the valid bit and the other bits are unused. So this is physical page number 111 and valid. So that's our physical page number. And I'm going to combine that with my original page offset of 0, and I find out I'm accessing address 0x39, and I get that the actual thing we access is right here. And I have this written out. So our first step is we do that array lookup. So this is finding out the address of the array element. And I find out our array element in this case is an address 26. The array starts at address 20. Our virtual page number is 6. Our page table entries are 1 byte. So we go 6 bytes into that array. We get our virtual our page table entry. We get this value F6. We have to decode it based on the information we have about what the page table format the processor chose was. We find out from that that it's valid and the physical page number is 111, and we use that just like our table. So questions? This process? So next time we'll start with more examples like this. This is very much like the first 4 questions in the memory homework, and the last 2 are dealing with our next topic for next time, which is going to be how do we avoid storing a whole big array when we have a giant number of virtual pages, which we're just going to use a tree-like data structure we'll talk about next time.